Hello and welcome to John Richardson and the Future Knots Book of Revelations. This is episode 10, The Future of Citizens, featuring our guest John Alexander. But before that, let me introduce my colleagues, my friends. It's Mark Stevenson and Ed Gillespie.
Hello, and what is wrong with you?
What do you think?
That was like Newsnight.
What the fuck?
You know, sometimes it's nice to have a fun at my incompetence, and sometimes it's nice to just that's who you want me to be, guys. I can be that guy.
Do we reveal at this point that you turned up to recording quarter of an hour late?
Yeah, I was rehearsing my sexy Radio 4 voice.
I don't like it.
No, I didn't think you would. That's why it's not that I don't remember the episode number or your names. It's just that I knew that was the best way to bring the best out of you. And I can be quite an intimidating guy when I've got my shit together. So I thought, you know, to settle everyone at their ease, what I'll do, I'll continually forget who we are, where we are, and what we're doing.
He's gaslighting us, Mark.
Now, I made a promise in the last episode that I would watch your TEDx talk, Ed.
Ooh.
And I did.
I'm sorry, John. You'll never get that time back.
You get a name check in it.
I do. I know.
Yeah. Have you watched it?
So you have watched it.
I have to watch it, don't I? I'll work with you.
Oh, did your heart fly when you heard your name mentioned?
I thought, oh, God, people are going to associate me with him again.
I think that tends to happen anyway.
Yeah, I know. I guess, really, if I didn't want to be associated with you, I shouldn't hang out with you all the time, work with you, and tell everybody how brilliant I think you are.
It's very good. It's very good. I got emotional at the end when you talk about loving the planet and how the planet doesn't want to be saved or rescued or changed. It wants to be loved. Mm. And it's been in my head a lot this week, a horrific story about a footballer, not the sort of thing that we're not sadly seeing a lot with these young men, but I've been thinking a lot about masculinity this week. And I think it's because I'm writing stand-up again, what men think they're supposed to be and how much damage it does. And I was very proud to see you speak in a very public forum in a way that I haven't seen anyone talk that emotively about the planet and just be very frank and honest and talk about feelings that are involved with this. And it's something we don't do a lot of, and I thought it was very good.
Oh, thank you, John.
Oh, shut up, the pair of you. It's making me sick.
And I look forward to hearing Quantum Pig's new album.
Well, it's a very emotional album, actually. There's a whole song in there about the need to see each other and hear each other and feel each other and all that kind of stuff. So,
is it longer than Ed's TED Talk?
Of course it's longer than Ed's TED Talk. It's prog rock.
Each track is longer than Ed's TED Talk.
Hey, we've got a gig. We are doing a national tour. Later in the year, we are supporting a much bigger band than us, and we will be playing some 1,000-seater venues, which is very nice. But I can't say when yet because we're still waiting for the tour dates.
I hope you get a bigger crowd than I got in my 1,000-seater venue.
Oh yeah, that was a gig you did in Norwich, about 15 people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, well, yeah, I didn't want to tempt fate last time, and I don't want to tempt fate again. With a tour to sell later this year, all I should be saying is it happens to us all, and the important thing is the content, right, guys? And if the show's good, it doesn't matter who's there.
But it does speak to the different levels of our celebrity in that my band will play venues that are smaller than you as an individual will feel.
Yes, but my audience will have a worse time. If it's any consolation to you.
I tell you what, you come to one of my gigs, I'll come to one of yours. We're playing Leeds. Is that anywhere near you now?
It's very near me. I'll bring Marcelo Bielsa.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know if he's into prog, and he's never replied to any of my messages. I know he's into cinema. So I'll just pretend there's a director coming. Is there a band called Cinema? Oh, that'll be the hilarious way I get him in.
There was nearly a band called Cinema, which was formed of ex-members of Yes and a guy called Trevor Rabin, but then that became the band Yes again under a new format. So Cinema never really existed, although they did sort of exist. So if you're into prog lore, Cinema's quite important. It's better than listening to your fucking poetry.
Which brings me to this. This week's episode is a belter and is a good old meaty chat, isn't it? So we need not to hang around any longer. discussing not just bands, but bands that didn't exist. I think that's when you know you're pushing it up. Bands that only existed in theory is a hell of a mastermind specialist subject, but it's not something for our listeners. So here we are to discuss. This is, I mean, it's a big old topic, isn't it? And if you're like me and you come to this new, it's a topic that shouldn't be a topic at all, let alone as big as it is, the idea that we should think of ourselves differently in a way that connects us to each other rather than alienates us from one another. But we have the wonderful John Alexander here, and I will hand to you, Ed, to introduce him.
So I first met John in about 2008 when we were both in different advertising and comms agencies, brushing up against each other in a polite but sharp-elbowed fashion over a mutual client. John worked in advertising for a decade. He won Brand Republic's Big Idea of the Year award for the concept My Farm in 2011, which handed over decision-making on a real working farm to the public by online vote and debate as a way of engaging people with sustainable food production. So eat your heart out, Jeremy Clarkson. He has also watched pigs rutting professionally. That was his professionalism, not the pigs. They were born to do it. He's got three master's degrees. I've only got two, but let's not get competitive. And he's won loads of awards for his essays and writing on topics as diverse as sustainable innovation, meritocracy, and new power. And his piece analysing the British government's response to COVID-19 through the lens of a citizen versus consumer story, which we will probably get well into later on, went viral and has been watched and read by at least 650,000 people. So he's publicly gobby, in a good way, and has done so all over the world, from the Athens Democracy Forum to TEDx Cardiff to Brand Week Istanbul. He's also increasingly active and visible politically as a fellow of the Young Foundation and the Royal Society of Arts, and a member of the World Economic Forum's Political Entrepreneurship Network and the Organisation for Economic and Cooperation Development's Innovative Citizen Participation Network. He's joining us here today as co-founder of the New Citizenship Project, a strategy and innovation consultancy that aims to shift the dominant story of the individual in society from consumer to citizen. And there he's worked with The Guardian, the European Central Bank, the European Journalism Centre, the BBC, Amnesty International, National Trust, the British Film Institute, Tate Galleries, the National Union of Students, YouGov, the Food Standards Agency, and the Food Ethics Council, to name but a few. And of course, his forthcoming, eagerly awaited new book, which is an absolute tour de force, Citizens, is out on the 17th of March. So, John, you really should get out more. He's also a mercilessly fit Ironman and has represented Great Britain in both rowing and triathlon. And I picture John as Wolfie Smith, fist raised in the air outside Tooting Broadway Tube Station, without the fag in the mouth and minus the fur coat and beret, but still shouting, power to the people. So welcome to the show, Citizen Alexander.
Thank you very much, Ed. And I would also like to assure people that I'm not a twat, which some of them...
I keep telling Ed to put that in the introductions, but he keeps leaving it out.
I feel like I needed it though, right? Yeah, it's all good. Thanks, Ed.
Does that introduction make you sound like a twat?
I don't know.
I must admit, I don't know John well enough to speak, but the Iron Man stuff, I was starting to wonder.
we'll try and prove it over that my assertion that I'm not a twat over the next little while, shall we? Where do you want to go? Where do we want to go first?
Well, the way we usually kick things off, as you're probably aware, is our first question, which in the context of being active citizens and in the world of citizenship, how fucked are we, John?
Well, I mean, the way I would probably put this is probably I'm going to be like the most negative of your discussants ever, and also the most positive at the same time, which should be fun. So basically, I think we're incredibly fucked and only getting more so. And yet at the same time, I think we have everything we need to unfuck ourselves and do it pretty quickly. But I'll come to that. We'll come to that a bit later, I'm sure. I mean, basically the reason why I say we're incredibly fucked is you just go, we're screwed and we are screwing ourselves up, because the story that we appeal to, the sort of the basis from which we try and draw our ways to fix things, that story itself is broken and is what is making things worse. So like we're ecologically fucked, and we're telling ourselves that our only agency is to buy stuff. The only thing we can do is to fix things, is to consume, and change individual behavior incrementally. We're kind of socially fucked and sort of divided and getting more divided, and yet we're living in a story that tells us that we should sort of accumulate and look out for number one, and that we are inherently individuals. And we're sort of loneliness, we're individually fucked. We're kind of lonely and unhappy and telling ourselves a story that the route to happiness is to sort of accumulate stuff. And so, yeah, I'd say we're in a pretty dire state, but I would also say that it's only a story, and that's sort of the heart of my work, really.
But it comes down to that, doesn't it? Because, I mean, there's so much, we've touched on issues of trust in a previous episode with Rachel Botsman, you know, and obviously, as we're recording this, you know, the levels of institutional trust are at such an all-time low. And that also sort of compels us to keep our focus close, doesn't it, when everything's going to shit. And I think a train conversation I had with a woman on the train, I just sat next to her down to London before Christmas. She asked me what I did, and we sort of started touching on a couple of things. And she said, you know, I live in my bubble. And she was really proud of that, you know, her sort of isolation and disconnection, that she didn't want to engage in any of the worlds of politics or big ideas or things. You know, it was almost like a pride she was taking in the fact that she was isolated and disconnected.
I think that's exactly right. But that's sort of a symptom of exactly what I'm talking about. So if I sort of unpack it a little bit, just the core set of ideas. So what I'm working with, I talk about essentially an idea that there is a dominant story of the individual in society at any given time, that there's a story that we kind of appeal to understand really how to be good. And for a long time, until the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, that story was something like the subject. So the right thing to do was to keep your head down and do as you're told, on the basis that the sort of God-given few knew best and would lead us to the best outcomes for society as a whole. Then that kind of collapsed in on itself for various reasons, which we can have some fun with if you want. But and out of that, in the middle of the 20th century, we got a new story, the idea of the consumer. So from subject to consumer. And the consumer story says, like, the right thing to do is to look out for number one, to stick to your bubble, as your lady put it, and to choose the best deal for you from the options that are offered, on the basis that pursuing individual self-interest, if everyone pursues self-interest, then that will add up to collective interest. Like, the best outcome for society will come from aggregating self-interest. And I would argue where we're at right now is that precisely is the story that is collapsing in on itself. And the hope comes from, I believe, from the idea that actually there's a different story emerging, what I call the citizen story, and the reason why everything I do in my life has the word citizen in it, which is basically like, get involved, share your own ideas, be part of the conversation about what's best for society as a whole, because that's the only way we'll actually figure it out. And so I'm not surprised by your lady, like, she's trapped in the story just as we all are. And in that story, it is kind of the right thing to do. It makes sense, particularly as things feel like they're getting worse, to kind of lock it down and stay in and stare at what you feel you can affect. But that in itself is part of the trap that the story sets us.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the story is kind of like, you feel kind of sort of helpless in the face of sort of, you know, what's going on in the world, but you also strangely feel complicit. And that is, you know, but you don't know what to do about it. So you kind of try and do a little bit less of maybe consuming, but you're still feeling complicit and helpless in this kind of shit show that we find ourselves in the beginning of the 21st century.
I think that's right. It's like the story tells us that the best we can aspire to do and be is the gentlest possible destroyers, like to fuck things up just a little bit less. Or a little bit more slowly is sort of the greatest aspiration we can have. When actually, like, sometimes people, I've been asked, like, what's the best thing an individual can do? And it's like, be less of an individual, right? Like, go and find your people, find your tribe, and get stuck in.
Talking about fucking things up, not as much as he might, or a person might. John, did you have something to say?
I was going to ask John if you could, because I think what would be good for the layman such as myself is to outline exactly what you mean by the difference between a citizen and a consumer. Because it strikes me that woman on the train, she feels like she can opt out of being a citizen. What she's saying is, I find this all very stressful, so the best thing I can do is opt out. She cannot opt out of being a consumer, and she may not be aware of quite how much she's being dictated to in the number of things that she's buying. And you talk in the introduction to the book about the number of advertisements and compulsions to buy that we see on a daily basis. So I think it will be useful to hit home for people. You are a consumer, whether you're trying to buy less or not. The world we live in is shaped to make you a consumer and not a citizen.
Yeah, and I think it's in a way the important distinction is to say, like, this isn't about, you're not a consumer whenever you do something that relates to business and a citizen whenever you do something that relates to government. Like, you are a consumer whenever you are living in a story where your agency is limited to choosing between the options that someone else offers. So you can be a consumer in relation to politics. If all you do is cast a vote every X years, you can be a consumer in relation to a charity if all you do is buy a thing from it or whatever. The point is that, as you say, like, we're surrounded by this story incredibly pervasively. So the way I sort of first started to think about this was when I started working in advertising. My first boss said to me, like, what you've got to understand, John, is that the average person sees 3,000 commercial messages a day, all of which are trying to sell them something, and your job is to cut through that. And for a while I was like, that's great, like, I can, that's a really lovely challenge, and, you know, with my sports like mindset, it was like I love competing for that. And then I was like, 3,000 times a day, all of those messages have the underlying message, you're a consumer. It's like one of the way, I didn't write this in the book, but one of the ways I think about this is it's like the world's most pervasive ever religion, right? Like, the most pervasive religions of our current day tell us, like, call us to prayer like five times a day, maybe. Consumerism is the religion of consumerism is calling us like 3,000 times a day under the radar and shaping how we think and how we act pretty much every moment. And so you can't help but be a consumer whether you actively identify. But what we can do is kind of actually defy that and step into a different idea of ourselves.
Because, I mean, you ask the question in the book, John, you say, you know, what are we doing to ourselves when we tell ourselves we're consumers that many times per day? And I think, you know, you and I, when we first met, you know, we were both sort of trying to wrestle with, if you like, that idea of conscious consumption. I think, you know, we hadn't quite sort of drunk the Kool-Aid or taken the red pill, but we were certainly, I think, both believers in the fact that we could probably bend this in some way, that we could operate within that sort of consumer story, although perhaps I think we were probably both doing it slightly unconsciously then. But you talk in the book really powerfully about your own sort of creeping epiphany, you know, where, you know, you said you're literally actually physically sick on a tube station platform because you felt that you just couldn't reconcile the tensions of working in advertising and marketing with the kind of desired outcomes that really needed to be achieved. Can you tell us a bit about what that felt like?
I mean, yeah, there was a pretty dark part of my life, I guess. Staring at this stuff and once I started to think of what I was part of producing, not as, I mean, there was a time when I really bought the story, right? Like, and maybe more explicitly than you, Ed, but like I went into advertising in large part because I was kind of 19 years old when the World Trade Center came down and our leaders told us to go shopping to sort of stand up for our society. And I kind of bought it to a large extent. And then as I first started asking questions about how to make the world better, how to try and use it, then I, as you say, I came to the sort of conscious consumption, like, can we sell greener stuff? Can we get people to take Eurostar instead of flying? That sort of work. But ultimately where I got to was this idea that it's not so much the individual message, it's the aggregate. And it's not just advertising, and I don't want to sort of demonize or kind of blame people who work in advertising, although I would advise you to change career. But I mean, there's things like the fact that the consumer confidence index is a key measure of success of our societies, that every time we think about the idea of how well a country is doing, it's GDP, and then the next step from GDP is people are going shopping very happily. And it's like that is what it is to be a good person, and that is precisely the problem. It's only by going there and by staring at it really hard that you can come out of the other side of it and go, actually, there's a whole different way we could be and do things. And that's really where my energy is now. It's like, it's what I sometimes say, I was like, it's not the, I didn't call it the Consumer Doom Project. I called it the New Citizenship Project, right? Like, that's the point.
I realised that was quite a long time for you. And obviously your low was a very low one. But to go back to advertising as an industry, do you get the sense of a lot of people feeling that way in that industry, or do you get the intent of, if there is such a thing as the industry, trying to shift a certain way, or do you feel like you still remain quite an outlier in that sudden revulsion at what you were being part of?
I think there's a lot of people in the industry are asking deeper and deeper questions. There's actually some really great work coming out, a gang called the Purpose Disruptors, building community and across the industry and facing into some of this stuff. I don't think anyone's really named this in the way I am doing. I think a lot of people, like, when I look around what's coming out of the industry, it still feels very 2010, right? Like, it's people are patting themselves on the back for selling greener stuff or finding a kind of a corporate social responsibility angle to their marketing or whatever. And it's like, we're kind of past that, guys. Like, we have to wake up to, it's like a lullaby. It's singing us to sleep to just go, no, like, we can buy our way out of this. We can individualize this down to, and, you know, small actions can change the world. And it's like, I mean, those, I don't want to come across as saying those small actions don't matter, but actually it's only when we get stuck in together and critically when leaders and institutions actually open up the power and the space for us to get involved that things really change.
Yeah, I mean, I totally concur with that. I mean, I think, you know, what you get is a lot of sort of self-congratulatory backslapping of people still operating, as you describe it, within that consumer story. And it's really marginal gains. And as you say, it's not that those small actions don't matter. But when people say, you know, if everyone does a little, it'll make a big difference, it's like, no, if everyone does a little, it makes a little bit of difference. You know, people constantly misread the basic physics of that. And, you know, I was really struck by, you know, in the book, you quote Morpheus in The Matrix, where he says to Neo, he says, you know, you're here because you know something. And what you know, you can't explain, but you feel it. And you've felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. And you don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind driving you mad. I mean, you clearly had that feeling. I had that feeling. And I think it takes a lot of courage to step out. And I think what you've started to do is articulate, obviously, where we go to from here. But it's also worth acknowledging, isn't it? It's like, why that consumer story was so compelling, isn't it, compared to where we came from historically?
Yeah.
I mean, you sort of mentioned the subject story, you know, where we have these strong sovereign leaders and it was very paternalistic and patriarchal and hierarchical. But in that sense, the moving from subject to consumer was really exciting, wasn't it? The reason this got so deeply embedded is it felt like a liberation.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I always think about a lot, and actually where naming the subject story came from for me was actually talking to my parents and thinking about their lives, because my mum found it quite hard when I was sort of rejecting this consumer story in a way. Like, she's deeply supportive of me, but she, look at it from her perspective, she was like, she remembers her family's first washing machine. You know, it was called a Hotpoint Liberator. And like, it deserves its name, right?
Sounds like a tank.
I know, but what? Yeah, it kind of does. But then when you think about what consumer goods have done in terms of time and space, what they could have given us, and when you think about what the consumer story is relative to what came before, relative to that idea of, like, keep your head down, do as you're told. I mean, I stumbled on the year 1984, and it's just like, as a sort of someone who's trying to tell a story, when you realize the year 1984 is significant, you have this little moment. But it's like 1984, you had the Apple launched the Macintosh and did it with this kind of this fanfare of you'll see why 1984, a ripoff of the film, and then saying Apple will launch the Macintosh and you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984. And they were basically saying, like, because the upstarts, the power will be put into the hands of the individual rather than the big establishment who will only sell you what they want to sell you. That same year you had Virgin Atlantic launching, flying doesn't have to international travel doesn't have to be being treated like cattle. That was Branson's language. And you also had Body Shop floating on the stock exchange, saying like you can buy stuff to save the planet. And all of this stuff happened in the same year with this vibe of, like, this is a golden dream. Like, we've cracked it, and it had been brewing for a long time. But I think, like, thinking about that as the promise, but then noting where that promise just hasn't been fulfilled and actually was inherently kind of broken helps you appreciate, like, not only that we are trapped and see that the consumer story is a fundamental problem, but understand why and how, because it did promise us liberation, it did promise a way forward, and yet, like, when you actually call it out, when you actually name the logic of it, this idea that, like, the pursuit of self-interest will add up to, it is Orwellian. It's selfishness is selflessness, right? It's bonkers. And when we name it, and when you actually spell it out, you just go, well, that's not right. That's not going to work.
John, there's a really good moment, like, really early on in the book, which kind of, I think, as an example, kind of really sort of exposes this very well, which is when you talk about Patagonia. So Patagonia is, for those listeners who don't know about it, is regarded as one of the most forward-thinking, progressive, climate-loving brands out there. And they make outdoor clothing, and they've done a lot of really great stuff, and are often held up as a kind of a poster boy for, you know, where the world needs to go in terms of the corporation. But you kind of unpick that, you know, with respect for them, you're doing it kindly, but you kind of say, actually, underneath that, even the most sort of progressive company, there's a fundamental problem. But could you just sort of run through that example? Because I found it particularly useful in helping expose the consumer story, even in the places where we think it's working well.
Yeah, and I mean, just to qualify, like, I actually wasn't trying to say, like, even the most progressive, even the best company is flawed. I was trying to say, like, yes, and like we can do so much more. I don't think Patagonia is a load of shit, right? Like, I'm a fan. The analysis I was offering really is that it can be summed up in pretty much a phrase, which is like the I think it was the CEO wrote something like, the single best thing we can do is consume in a less damaging way. Like, it's almost kind of word for word explicitly said, and like, the single best thing. And a lot of their what they've done is sort of directed at that. And I guess what I'm really talking about in this is like, actually, at the root of it, the consumer story is really a kind of a massive, like, species level self-hatred complex. It's like the single best thing we can do is do less damage, rather than, like, the single best thing we could do is create wonder and beauty and brilliance together. Mm. Like, And I talk in the book about, like, what if Patagonia didn't, I mean, they became famous for that "don't buy this jacket" ad. If people haven't seen it, it's worth checking out. And it was made a big noise in Black Friday back about a decade ago. It was like, they said, you know, don't buy our stuff, and we'll make stuff that will last forever. And you're like, great. But what if they could, I guess if I was sort of casting into a citizen story, like, what if they could embrace that, the idea that people are sources not just of consumption that can be decreased, like minimized in its negative impact, but sources of ideas and energy and resources and creativity that can be channeled and harnessed to create wonder and beauty. And it's like, what if Patagonia's campaign was like, I am nature, rather than just don't buy this jacket, right? Like, it's, how could they champion and support and draw on the ideas of all of us to and actually the ownership of all of us to create a different relationship between people and nature, rather than just sort of say don't fuck things up quite as much. That'd be nice.
Yeah. I mean, it's terrifying, isn't it, that the extent of our sense of agency becomes really binary, that we're either destroyers or saviors. And I was really struck by the line where you said, you know, we've become so intoxicated by our power to choose that we forget that the real power is in designing the menu. You know, it actually lies upstream. And I think the stories you also tell around, you know, working with NGOs and charities, you know, particularly in this context of, like, effective altruism, where there's a sort of cold, logical, rational efficiency of giving, you know, where you focus in on where you spend the best money to save the most lives. And that can end up in a really weird place, can't it? Because, it, you know, I think the example you use is of like saving a Picasso from a burning building rather than a child, because you get more money by saving the Picasso, and then you can use that to save more children elsewhere. But, you know, there's that sort of false approach that comes through when you have a consumer approach to charitable giving.
Yeah, absolutely. And my friend Edgar Villanueva wrote a book called Decolonizing Wealth about philanthropy and about charity. And he has this wonderful way of putting it, which comes from his kind of indigenous wisdom background. He talks about, like, there's this phrase, all our relations, and this idea that actually, like, altruism in itself is a flawed construct, because there is only all our relations. There is, and when you see the world in that sense, when you step out, one of the ways we talk about the shift from consumer to citizen is that it's a shift from kind of this myth of independence and atomized individual to interdependence, and like knowing that we need one another. And in that charitable context, it's about going, well, look, we're all givers and receivers at different times, but actually, like, we all have a contribution to make, and that is the most exciting aspect of this. Everyone can and wants to contribute to the world if we're given the context to do so. And so, like, in that sense, you get beyond the kind of there's an us and a them, and the us might give to them or not, and go, like, how can a bigger us, to use the language of people like Alex Evans and others, to sort of actually look at the world together and go, like, how do we just do this better? And how can we draw on the ideas and energy and resources? And some people are bringing money as their form of resources, and others are bringing other stuff. Like, how do we bring all of that to do this better, rather than how do we sort of mechanistically, I mean, my favorite way of sort of blowing the effective altruism thing out of the water is actually, I think, Desmond Tutu's originally, is like, we need to, the famous effective altruism thought is like, Peter Singer, one of the architects of it, talks about the life you can save, and you should always, if you can pull the drowning child out of the pond as you walk past, then you always should. And Tutu had this thing where it's like, well, maybe we need to go upstream a bit and find out why there are so many children in the pond before we spend all of our time pulling people out, right? Like, because otherwise they might just get thrown back in. And I think that's that sort of logic is very citizen logic. It's like, who are we and how do we get stuck into this, rather than like, how do we fix the immediate thing that I can do right in front of me with the minimal amount of expense usually.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you're talking, John, it reminds me, like, when we are thinking about, you know, how well our society is doing, it always comes down to, you know, how well is the economy doing, you know? And that's often, like, on the BBC, we go, well, you know, here's what's happening with the retail price index, or here's how the economy is going, or here's the prime minister, you know, whether it's left or right, talking about the economy and jobs and all that kind of stuff. But there's never any kind of, like, how is governance doing? How is social cohesion doing? You know, they're just not there. There's only this one measure, which is the economy and your ability to participate in that, either as a supplier or a buyer, which seems, you think about it, it just seems completely bonkers.
Yeah, I mean, I think the example that I love most, and the story that when I was digging into it for the book, like, really made my hair stand on end, and I was like, this is actually, like, this is happening, this is fully real, was actually the story of what's been going on in Taiwan over the last decade. And it's really fascinating you made that observation, because that Taiwanese story starts in exactly this place. So back in 2012, the government, Taiwanese government, was trying to rush through a trade deal with mainland China. It was sort of, and it was called, and it, they published a big thing. They talked about the economic power up plan, and they literally put messages out, put TV ads and so forth out that said, like, don't, like, let's not sort of get all complex and confused. Like, we'll look out, we'll sort the economy, and you guys just stick, get on with your lives, and we'll do it for you. And it was that triggered a group of hackers, actually software developers in what's quite a high tech society, to come together and start organizing. And they called themselves GovZero, which is lovely, because all of the URLs of their websites have g0v.tw instead of .gov.tw. But they basically built parallel websites to government websites and started involving people in shadow versions of the discussions that different government departments were having. And it was built quite gradually. But then 2014 comes, and this trade deal comes before the parliament. and it triggers a massive student protest, right? And Occupy style. And then the students occupied the legislature and started, what they'd started doing was debating the clauses of this trade bill. And the hacker collective got a broadband connection in and streamed out footage of what the students were doing, so people around the country could see what was happening. And then this critical moment came where the Speaker of the Parliament actually said, "This is democracy. This is what it looks like. This is what should be happening in this space," and stood on the side of the students. And from then on, the whole picture flipped. And now, like, there was this wonderful, the Taiwanese approach to COVID was basically rooted in seeing the whole thing as a national team effort, believing for a start that everyone was capable of contributing and was capable of dealing with the reality of the situation. So they never hid anything. They never pretended it was smaller. They published all of the information. They set challenge prizes to build apps that would help. My favorite example was they did this thing where they set up a phone line where any citizen could help come up with ideas for how the response could be better. And like the whole thing went from a kind of consumer economic paradigm of the decisions that will be made entirely kind of on the basis of what is best for the economy, to a kind of participatory, open, involving world where all of us were part of it.
And that kind of society led to them, you know, developing their test and trace app, I think, in about a matter of days, and it worked straight away, pretty much, whereas ours took, like, you know, weeks and months and cost billions and failed quite miserably.
Yeah, exactly that.
We've talked about something similar to this in the future of leadership, that being very honest about the problems is actually engaging. How is it that we don't, because in terms of the problems we face with climate and COVID and things like that, we talk a lot about how serious everything is, but clearly we're not doing it in a way that is seen as honest, and people don't feel able to be involved in it. Do you think it's the way we talk about things, or do you think it's a fundamental failure of honesty that we know there are big problems, but we don't know the truth about how to deal with them?
I don't know. I think I look at it a little bit differently, maybe, which is that The critical thing I'm looking for is agency, and like what is it that people can do that's commensurate with the scale of the challenge? And I think that the real failure of leadership isn't so much the suppression of information, it's the failure to acknowledge agency, to acknowledge what it is that people can really do. To make that a bit more real, like I think the moment I felt like I absolutely had to write this book was actually the moment when the message back in May 2020, do you remember when the message changed from stay home to stay alert? And everyone was like, what is this? And in my mind, it was a moment when the sort of the subject story, the kind of paternalism was falling away. And yes, they were suppressing information and so on and so forth. And we know that now, but what they were doing more was saying, the responsibility is personal, like it's on you. And I think that's the greatest failure we've got in climate and so on as well, is that we're still trapped in a mode of saying, you as an individual, this is what you can do, when actually, like, what was going on in that moment in time, going back to the COVID situation, was that if you remember, like, mutual aid groups had sprung up all over the country. We had those viral kindness postcards. Do you remember where it's like, if you're isolating, I can help you with this, dropping through letterboxes. We had 750,000 people apply to become NHS first responders and crash a website that had been built for 250,000 over 3 weeks. That's 750,000 in like 48 hours. And what could have happened in that time, I think, in that moment of shifting the message, could have been like coming in behind that energy and as in Taiwan, sort of setting those challenges and opening out for ideas and building a sense that we would figure this out together. I've talked elsewhere about like setting up a deliberative democracy kind of citizens reference panel or something to be part of the decision-making process. We could have been involved rather than just told or dictated to in any way. And I think that for me, it's not so much like withholding information, it's like it's structuring opportunity, it's creating the spaces and the modes. That's true leadership, is yes, being honest, but also taking the challenge of facilitation, really, like creating the spaces and the structures through which people can do stuff meaningfully. And that is the task of the leader, I reckon.
And that was a massive failure, wasn't it? Because ultimately, you know, we know now obviously the ongoing saga of all the parties that were clearly going on, you know, during lockdown in Number 10 and various government departments. It's like, it's a sort of lack of trust of the public, isn't it, by a paternalistic sort of subject story led leadership. And in some ways, perhaps that's just a projection from them. It's like they didn't trust us to do the right thing because they weren't doing the right thing themselves. You know. But the way you describe that shift, you know, to Stay Alert as being more about a consumer story, you know, about saying, you know, this is about a preservation of power on the part rather than a facilitation and an opening up and building on those mutual aid groups and all that incredible grassroots resilience, which was happening, you know, pretty much in spite of government rather than because of it.
Yeah, absolutely in spite of rather because. And I think that the worry I have about this moment that we're living in right now and with like the party gate and all this stuff is that, like, yes, I mean, that stuff is properly appalling, right? Like, these people shouldn't be anywhere near leadership positions. But, like, the deeper shift, like, not many other countries actually opened up to this. Like, the story has hold in more places and goes deeper than just, like, we're not going to fix this by getting rid of Boris, basically. That's the sort of, and I worry that we miss that. The thing about trust and do they trust us? The moment in the writing of the book where I just like, my mind was blown was I interviewed Audrey Tang, who's the Taiwanese digital minister. And in the interview, I said, people must really trust the government of Taiwan for you to do this stuff. Like, I mean, they're doing stuff like this helpline, this idea line, like a 6-year-old boy would ring up and say like, and offer an idea. And it was a wonderful idea, by the way, about the baseball team. And then he was on the TV show the next day, but it was like, for that to be done, people must really trust government to phone in and to let their kids phone in and all this. And what she said to me was really profound. She said, we don't care. In fact, we don't even want people to trust the government because people trust the government in other countries and we can see how that works. What we care about is that the government trusts people. Mm. And it's just this like profound flip of like of what this whole role of government, the relationship between state and citizen actually is, to go, no, like this starts with the government trusting the people and respecting them and providing them with the context and opportunities that are required to enable us to do stuff together. That's the nub of this.
So, John, I've got sort of two, not challenges, but sort of two points of view to kind of sort of widen out the conversation a bit. The first is that as we've all become consumers and trapped in the consumer story, you could argue that actually you couldn't trust us because we, as consumers, having been trained to be consumers, we'd come up with consumer answers. So that could be one reason they don't want to do it. And another reason sometimes that's given to me is that people say, well, you know, involving people is all very well and good, but it's the management overhead is very, very hard. And it's much easier to manage 3 people in City Hall than, you know, thousands and thousands of citizens. So they say it's an efficiency play. Well, actually, it's just not an efficient way to run a state. How would you sort of counter those two arguments?
I mean, there's not very much evidence for either. The first one is I think that the argument I would make is that when you ask people meaningful questions from a meaningful place, then people take on that responsibility. So the best example is probably the way that the Irish government developed the shift in policy on abortion. So the way that started, actually, the referendum is famous, right? So in 2018, there was a referendum where 66% of the Irish population voted to legalise access to abortion up to 12 weeks. But the way that proposal was developed was by a citizens' assembly. So 99 randomly selected Irish citizens, representative of the national population, coming together for 5 weekends over 5 months to develop that proposal, pretty much consensus-based process. And that was single parents, lorry driver, like everyone, Catholics, Protestants, like the whole shebang in that room. And being given that meaningful power in order to do stuff, it's when you don't give people meaningful power and when it is actually a trivializing process that people kick back. I mean, sometimes the Boaty McBoatface thing. Do you remember Boaty McBoatface when research council? Yeah. And that's probably an example of what you're sort of hinting at, right? It's like you open up for people's ideas and they'll suggest something like Boaty McBoatface and vote for it. Actually, I mean, even that, I think that's true in some ways as an example, but I'd argue it's because it was a pretty trivial opportunity for engagement and people didn't really believe that it would be taken seriously. But even that, I would argue, actually has done an awful lot. Like the guy who proposed the name Beatty McBoatface then got into conversation with them and came on side with them naming the boat David Attenborough and got everyone who'd voted for his idea to support it as well. And then they did name a submarine on the boat Beatty McBoatface, and people have followed that on Twitter and so forth. And it's been a major channel of connection to that research council.
I think, yeah, as you say, it's got to be something more sophisticated than just naming something.
Right.
It? It's exactly, like, yeah. I mean, there's an examples I used to use in my presentations when Greenpeace invited people to name a whale that they were tracking to follow whale migration routes. And the winning vote was Mr. Splashy Pants. And it was like, you know, and then I think Mountain Dew, you know, the soft drinks company, also had a kind of name a new flavor competition. And they had to pull it when the winning one was what called Hitler Had the Right Idea. You know, these things getting hacked. But again, you know, that's because the ask is relatively trivial. If you actually give people something much more substantive, and I think citizens' assemblies, you know, and more meaningful engagement around solutions. I mean, I think the other example you use in the book is Taiwan's crowdsourced regulatory response to Uber, which I think you said took 4 weeks.
Yeah, and that's the perfect response to the speed challenge, I think. Yeah, crowdsourcing that, where you open up for ideas from everywhere, you use technology. And this is one of the reasons why the citizen story actually could take hold now in this moment in time. Like, the tech is there that we can actually tap into collective intelligence and bring ideas from everywhere in a way that maybe hasn't been possible before. And I think that's part of it. But I think so many of those defences, those rejections come from a place of actually underneath it, like thinking that people are a bit shit. That's the sort of real challenge.
Is that a gradual process though? Because we're obviously now into sort of, I guess, how we unfuck ourselves. And you've put a very good case for what can be done and what it looks like when it's done. It's very inspiring. And I'm sort of worried to ask the question, how do we start to do then? Because we've also discussed a lot of people doing a little is still a little. So is it fermenting a situation where a lot of people suddenly feel empowered to do a lot, or is it gradual openings up of areas in which people can see, oh, if you trust us to make a decision and it's done well, then it's of benefit to everyone?
I think the first thing, so first just to say, like, I don't think it has to take ages. I mean, Taiwan's, like I said, 2012, they were pretty much where we are now with a government trying to kind of swing through without involving us at all and so on. So, and 10 years on, they're in a wholly different place. So just in terms of, like, first point, then to recognize that actually people are already doing this stuff. And everyone is doing stuff in their own lives. Like, in every community, if you start to look, you will find that there are organizations and people kind of coming together to figure stuff out. And the next part of it is then, like, okay, how do you open the door to that? One of the things I sometimes like to say is that it's not that we sort of have to learn to be citizens. We are citizens by nature. We just have to stop telling ourselves that we're consumers all the time and let that take hold, give it the oxygen. And so in terms of, like, how this shift happens, then it's like the critical moments are the ones where organizations kind of open up and let people have a say, it can be charities, it can be businesses, it can be governments. And so it's in that sense, a lot of people doing a little is really powerful. So, and the phrase that Israeli complexity theorist, who's a amazing woman, who's a mentor of mine, who has the phrase social acupuncture. It's like, when in all these different places across our society, organizations and institutions and government and business and so on open up power to people and speak to us as citizens rather than just as consumers. That is the stuff that will add up. That is the release of the energy that will then really start to flow, because it is in our nature to do so. So it's like, and in the book I talk about everyone from, like, National Trust to Parkinson's UK to BrewDog to Riverford to government departments are doing it. The Bank of England's doing it in some ways. Like, and it's that's what gives me hope, is that this is actually like a surging story of points of light that are actually beginning to connect and add up. And I really believe it could happen very, very quickly.
Although to John's point, it's certainly the case, for instance, like if you look at participatory budgeting, you know, lots of places try it and then they stop because, you know, it's not a meaningful engagement, you know, so they'll put up a small amount of the city budget or whatever. And then the process is difficult, people don't know how to do it. So it kind of doesn't do very well in the first year and people kind of go, oh, well, that didn't work, so we'll stop. And what, you know, lots of studies on into participatory budgeting have found is like, you need to keep on doing it, you know, do it for 5 years, do it for 6 years, put meaningful amounts of money on the table. And then pretty soon, you know, within sort of 5 or 6 years, people will expect to be asked, whereas rather than distrusting this process. So there has to be a commitment to saying, like, we're not just going to try this, you know, next month, and if people don't participate, we're fucked. You've got to say, we're going to carry on doing it.
I think the example you give, participation budgeting, is exactly an example of what we were talking about before. Like, many places have sort of tiptoed into it with, as you say, small amounts of money, sometimes treated as a shadow process to see what people would say. And of course, people have not really engaged with that because it's trivial. Whereas, but actually there are places, I mean, Paris is a wonderful example. The city of Paris at the moment is really fascinating. I don't know. So they've been doing participatory budgeting for a long time. I think it's up to like 100 million euros a year. And they also they've just, I think next week, the first meeting of the Paris Citizens Assembly. So they've created a standing Citizens Assembly to be part of the ongoing city administration. So a bit like it's effectively playing a role a bit like the House of Lords in the UK, but it's randomly selected citizens holding the elected representatives to account and commissioning citizen inquiries into particular issues on an annual basis. So there is in the city of Paris, there's other stuff similar in Brussels in some ways. There's really interesting stuff going on in various cities in Poland. Like these like really deep commitments to power are happening, and they're happening like you say, 5-6 years can be the timescale in some places, but actually in others it takes hold an awful lot quicker, particularly because like in those places where it comes from public demand. I think one of the things I'm working on most at the moment is like creating the structures, creating like little processes and bigger processes that open the door to government to step into. Actually, on this, one of my biggest, the people I sort of, or the organization, as it were, that I would probably criticize most for this not actually having taken hold in Britain isn't so much our current government. It's actually, I've got a bit of a beef with Extinction Rebellion on this front. It's because of the Climate Assembly. So when XR first kicked off, right, they were, one of their key asks was for a Citizens Assembly. And that was absolutely the right ask. And they wanted it to be commissioned by government, and they wanted it to be legally binding, and they wanted it to have a timescale of net zero by 2035, I think. And then what happened was that 6 select committees, so not the government, but 6 select committees with meaningful power and meaningful voice in Parliament, came together to commission a Citizens' Assembly on climate. Obviously, it didn't have binding power because it wasn't the government, and it had a remit of net zero by 2050 rather than 2035. But it was there, and it was real, and it was the citizen voice. And my beef with XR is that the response of XR was to say, no, like, not good enough, not interested, and to ignore it. And I'm like, what could have happened in that moment, I believe, was that they could have gone, yes, and, right? In classic sort of improv fashion. Yes, and, like, we will line up our rebellions, our protest moments, alongside each of the gatherings of that Citizens' Assembly. I think it had 5 gatherings over 5 months, a bit like the Irish one. And we will make it impossible to ignore. And we will keep saying that it's not big enough and it's not strong enough and it's not good enough. But we will make it so noticed. And all the ingredients were there. David Attenborough spoke at it, you know, like all of, and the recommendations it came out with were profound and really powerful and almost universally acknowledged as being the right stuff to do and to happen. And I just, I fundamentally believe that if XR had gone, look at this, listen to this and go further, rather than going, nah, not good enough, we could be in a very different place right now. And that's, I mean, I'm open to being told that I've got that completely wrong. But I guess part of what I'm saying in that, and part of what that I think exemplifies about what this work is about, is it's not just a critique of of government and of people in power and sort of the little people saying, oh, listen to us. It's actually, it's on us as well to create the space and to say yes and to push that to happen. And I think there's ways of doing that.
I mean, I totally agree with you, John, you know, that I felt very, very similar. And one of the things you often find, I think, is that when people have defined themselves in opposition, when they get what they want, they don't quite know what to do. So they start opposing the thing that they asked for. Because it's like, what do I do now? Well, I only know how to oppose things, so I'm going to oppose that. And that's you know, that's also not participatory, really. It's kind of like, you know, it's setting yourself against everybody else. And actually, when people come around, they don't quite know what to do.
I think that's really insightful.
They're a fascinating example of Extinction Rebellion, because they are, you know, they're all about us acting and doing things and the power of, you know, individuals to do great things. But they are also incredibly polarizing. And I meet far more people who say to me, I want to be behind them, but I'm not, than I do people who, you know, say, oh, this is fantastic. This is exactly what we should be doing, taking control ourselves.
I think that's right. You're totally right. Like, I don't know whether we consciously acknowledge it, but I think there's a big part of us as humans that sort of wants to not just reject, but to build, right? And I think that's some of where that's coming from. One of the things that my work is often mistaken for is an argument that everyone should be an activist. Like, if you're not like citizen equals activist, and it's actually really like one of the, yes, being an activist, protesting is one of the things that citizens do, and I think particularly in this country at the moment with the policing bill and so on, it's really critical to defend that right. And I'm not saying that. But as you say, Ed, like there is more to it. There is proposal, not just reaction. And there is creation, not just rejection. And I think that possibility demands actually that at least part of what we do is to come into our, I talk in the book about the idea of home and like, where are the places and communities, and that might be geographic or it might be work-based or whatever, where you have agency and you can be part of building something and you can gather those around you to do so. And I love the way Rob Hopkins, who wrote a book called From What Is to What If, I think, he has this phrase. He says, if we wait for governments, it'll be too late. And that sort of, that speaks to protest. Don't just reject the governments. He says, if we wait for governments, it'll be too late. If we act as individuals, it'll be too little. But if we come together as communities, it might be just enough, just in time. And I think that sort of speaks to the thing I was saying earlier about like the best thing an individual can do is be less of an individual. It's like we are the power, we all have power actually. And part of the shift from consumer to citizen, it sort of goes back to the lady you were talking about at the beginning, Ed, the sort of I'm in my bubble. It's like, well, get the out of it then, like because we you have power, like and not using the power that you have as a member of local community, as an employee of your organization or as an employer, not using the power you have is the greatest sort of dereliction of duty really in this moment.
I mean, you talk about Baratunde Thurston, don't you, in the States, who talks about how to citizen and make it, says it's a verb, you know, and actually citizenship is a muscle, you know, it's not just a verb, because it's not just a noun, that sort of possessive exclusive thing. And we talk about in terms of citizenship or, you know, selling golden passports to rich Silicon Valley tech giants. But, you know, citizenship's a muscle that you've got to flex and you've got to exercise it. Otherwise it atrophies. And in a way, the consumer story has enabled it to atrophy. And what we need to do is just start exercising it again, vigorously, in a sort of Iron Man type way. And what better person to inspire that than you, John?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me very much of the quote by Alice Walker, the American novelist who wrote The Color Purple and a bunch of other great novels. She said something along the lines of, the quickest way people give up their power is by believing they don't have any.
Yay. Yeah, that really strikes. I mean, the only thing I would add to what you just said, Ed, is like, it's a muscle you build and a muscle you have to work, but also like it's a muscle that when you start using it, you really enjoy using it and you feel stronger and you feel healthier and you feel like part of it. And it's just great. Like, and that I think That is the true power. I got that, the phrase, the citizenship is a muscle you build, not a cup you empty. I got from a guy called Stephen Green, who was involved in the setting up of the National Citizen Service, and used to run a thing called Rock Corps. And the way Rock Corps works they set up these enormous, amazing gigs, like huge artists. And the only way to get a ticket to the gig was to do 4 hours of community action. What Stephen told me was that 90, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, so don't publish these in an academic journal or whatever. I can't see that happening. But Stephen said 90-odd percent.
How dare you?
Oh, no, I'm very dare. 90-odd percent of the young people who did the community action did it solely to get the gig ticket. But 70-something percent of them went on to do more community action that was completely unrewarded. And I think that hints at it, right? It's like, how do you give people that first? And 4 hours is enough. To John, to your thing earlier, like, does this take ages? It's like, nah, 4 hours, dude. We're on it.
Yeah, I wrote their purpose, moving a generation to change the world.
We're doing something very similar, actually. With I'm doing some gigs at the moment for the charity Fair Share, who say financially they're sort of okay. What they need is volunteers. And if you put on a gig, they'll raise a bit of money, but the people that come in the building might never leave again. And we're looking to either make the tickets free to people who sign up to volunteer, or at least discounted for people who go on the mailing list, to sort of build that idea that it's part of a relationship for the audience coming that will go on beyond the gig.
Do you know, John, I love that phrase, the people who come in the building might never leave again, I think is just great. Like, and the same was in the work I did at the National Trust, where part of what we did was to try and reframe that relationship as being like the joy of experiencing beauty in the world, rather than just like purchasing a day out. And when you just sort of see things differently, frame them a little bit differently, people do come into that. And then once you experience it, once you're part of that kind of story, you don't want to leave again. I think one of the things I really want to hammer home in this work is like, the citizen story isn't a heavy and worthy and hard and horrible. I mean, actually the story that's heavy and hard and worthy is trying to fix the world from within the consumer story. Like, the work of trying to consume your way to a better world is bastard hard and requires you to be a saint, right? Like, the work of being a citizen is play, actually. It's like meeting people and doing stuff together and knowing one another and finding joy and doing what makes you feel like you're alive. And that's such a relief. Compared to the kind of, I think one of the things the consumer story does is make being a change maker, trying to do something different in the world, really like awful. It's one of its self-preservation mechanics.
Well, it's clear because the fact we have change stories, I mean, like we said, we've shifted from a subject to a consumer story. And, you know, the problem, as you talk about in the book, is that, you know, that took two world wars and millions of people dead and a very long time to shift. And we need to do it much faster, like you elocute and articulate in that great Taiwan example. But we can begin to shift this. But, you know, the challenge is, like, how do you shift a cultural narrative of citizenship, you know, from the consumer story? And I think that's where your book was really compelling for me, because it is about the big and the small, isn't it? What are the kind of the huge headline and attention grabbing ideas that capture the imagination? And you talk about a sort of crowdsourced version of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to become a sort of global constitution for the human race. But, and that would be obviously mind-blowing and potentially involving people all over the world. But also, it is that sweating of the small stuff. I was really, you know, inspired when you first started out on this journey and you gave a talk and a presentation which was all about, you know, not killing the consumer, but stop calling people consumers, because of the psychological priming that occurs when you label people as consumers, which makes them self-interested, slightly selfish, and obsessed with their own rights, as opposed to that psychological priming of citizenship, which is more selfless, expansive, and about responsibilities. And I think that sweating the small stuff matters too, doesn't it? Whether it's job titles, the way we talk about things in meetings. And again, in my agency life, you know, I desperately tried to get us to formally reject the label of consumer, which is really tough when you're working with corporate clients all the time, because they just, that's their fallback, that's their default. They don't want to go into that sort of space. So what's your take, John, on how this sort of cumulative big and small elements of the narrative come together to create the sort of higher level shift?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the first thing, as you say, is like, stop using the word consumer, because I mean, that single word has immense power. I didn't really put this stuff into the book, but there's some really fascinating social psych research where, like, even in like the single word consumer, if you put consumer response study on the front cover of a survey of environmental and social motivations, for half the people get that, and half the people get citizen response study. Like, and they're the same, like nationally, all demographically the same and all that kind of stuff. The people who get the consumer response study will report lower social environmental motivation. Like, the single word actually unconsciously presented primes you to be more selfish. So anyone who is listening to this who works in any sort of industry where you use the word, like, just don't. Like, you don't have to say citizen. Just don't talk consumer. But the bigger point, I think, Ed, is we talk about... I've started to talk about the idea of like totems and rituals, like to stand for the kind of the big symbolic, the things that really kind of carry the story, and the rituals, the day to day. And it's, and these things are in, like you say, are in every organization. It's like, and I do think the idea of you talk about the idea of a crowdsourced version, like renewal of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights might sound like totally utopian. But actually, I reckon if Oxfam International and Amnesty International and a couple of others got together in sort of the similar spirit I was talking about, XR, kind of, they could do something like that outside of the UN and sort of push the UN to adopt it. Like, it cost a couple of million quid. We've got there is such a thing as a global assembly that's been developed and run on climate. Like, these things, all of the stuff you need is there. It's not expensive to do and would send an incredibly powerful story. And then we need to put that together with, like, what are the sort of day-to-day shifts that can be different? One of the projects I'm most excited about on that sort of ritual level, but on a global stage, as it were, is I'm working with various people on the concept of a citizen confidence index as opposed to the consumer confidence index. Like, what would it look like to measure and report the extent to which people feel able to shape the world that they live in, rather than just the confidence people have that they can consume more? And I would argue, actually, for the time being at least, that would probably be a more there are good reasons to believe that could be a more powerful indicator of economic prosperity than consumption as well. That totem and ritual thing translates also into an individual organization. So, like, at the National Trust, one of the totems was a campaign called 50 Things to Do Before You're 11 and 3 Quarters that was about, like, crowdsourcing a list of things that people could do to with their kids to build a connection to nature. And that campaign has run for years and been very famous in the organization and sent the organization a message about what kind of organization it is. But also, like, we were paying attention to, like, what are the photos on meeting room walls, and do they have, because before we started, they were like glamorous pictures of places with no person in sight. And it's like, well, if we're trying to connect people in place, then we need to see people enjoying those places. And so if you see what I mean, it's like, it's the big and the small, it's the totem and the ritual, whether you're talking about an individual organization, which then in itself is an intervention point. I mean, the National Trust has 5 million members, right? And the role it's played in British society in the last couple of years is really fascinating. Or whether you're talking about the global thing of how you shift this whole story.
So John, I think it's been great having you on. But we talk a lot about mental health on this show.
Mainly Marx.
fuck off. It's not surprising I suffer having to hang out with you two.
Friends like these, Mark.
Indeed, indeed. But, you know, you're a man who, you know, by your own admission, had had a kind of a fairly traumatic and dark period. And you're also doing quite an extraordinary job in sort of, you know, trying to shift up the whole generational narrative in a way. What do you do to keep yourself, you know, getting up in the morning? Because you know, it's not like you've set yourself a small task there.
I don't know. I mean, I hate to sound cheesy, but like,
Oh, is this where you're going to prove you're a wanker?
Yeah. Oh, damn. It was all going so well.
Oh, no. I fell at the last hurdle.
Oh, no. No, I don't find, like, I love this work. I genuinely believe that every one of us is like a capable, caring, like creative, like brilliant creature. And I go out in the world and I'm like, well, how do we unleash this? And I just get so much joy from it. And you just, yeah, of course, there are moments when I look at the headlines and the stories and feel like that this isn't going to take hold. And in those times, like getting out for a run, I know like this is the risk of sounding like a twat because you've read out that sport is something I have done reasonably well in my life a couple of times, but it's really a kind of, for me, it's much more the continuation of sport in my life is more about a kind of meditative space. It is like the feeling of being out for a run in the trees is medicine. But for the most part, and for now at least, and maybe I know we all go through peaks and troughs, but I really am filled with like a sense that we are enough. Like we have everything we need, and maybe it's because I'm about to put this out into the world, right? Maybe I'm feeling really positive because I feel like I'm about to be able to offer something that I've sort of carried the burden of just on my own, like not on my own. That's not fair with the team and stuff. But we've kept sort of private, and there's an anticipation of putting it into the world that makes me feel particularly positive. And maybe if it doesn't take hold and I sell 50 copies, and then I'll be struck down. I don't know, but I feel like we can. And I feel like what I'm trying to do in the book is name that and make that story that we could step into and all the ways it could help us flourish and help us find much more joy in our lives, like make that available to people and probably sounding like a twat, which was the thing I was trying to avoid.
No, well, what you're doing is shying away from celebrating being positive. It's one of the most fascinating things about this podcast and everything we talk about, citizenship, veganism, climate change, whatever it is we talk about, the people engaged in it who make the change and become part of the future solution become happier and more engaged. And yet it is the hardest thing to convince people because so much of it feels like you have to do this. Citizenship is a burden. You need to take action and you can't hide in a bubble and you can't eat the things you want and you can't go on the holidays you want. And actually so much of being part of the, you know, more streamlined and better way of life makes you feel happier. But we just don't have that conversation very well.
Yeah, amen to that. It's a joy.
And I think, John, you know, you're also being humble. I mean, you know, you talk at the very end of the book about getting beyond the sort of heroism aspect of this, you know, where, you know, heroes are always about individualism and self-reliance, aren't they? Which is very consumer story and a bit cultish. And it can involve all those sort of savior complexes of great white straight men. But, you know, it's about being anti-heroes. It's about stepping back, isn't it? About giving space and about flourishing and trusting. And that's where the emergent joy comes from. As you say, we've got the capacity to do this. We've got the platforms to do this. We've also got the inclination, and it's almost like we're not recognizing it within ourselves. And I think that's the beauty of it for me. You know, we've got to get out of our own way and have more fun while we're doing it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That moment of seeing not just yourself, but others, those around you as citizens, it's like you start to ask yourself this question of like, and this is where I finished the book actually. And like the idea of an anti-hero is one where, and it's something I'm sort of speaking to myself, as you often do at the end of writing a book, as I can judge from reading others. Like you come back and you go, so what are you actually saying to yourself? And what I'm really saying to myself is like, pass the mic. Like I'm sort of about to turn 40. I was 6 foot. I'm a decent athlete. I mean, like, I look and sound like the people who were brought up to believe that they would lead the world to safety. And I've got my own hero complex. I'll admit to that. But actually, the work is of opening the door, of passing the mic and being the platform, not the actor. And I think that. That makes me where I end the book is this question, like, what would you do in this time if you really believed in yourself and those, both in yourself and in those around you? What would you do in this time if you really believed in yourself and in those around you? And I think that question is where I'm really happy to have left the book on that note, because I think it just invites us all into something that really can be joyful, but also like really important, I hope.
There you go. You just sold more than 50 to our listeners. That's it. So the age you might need to have. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for having me, guys.
So there we go. That was our interview. What are your thoughts after the event, Mark?
I think the thing that keeps coming back to me, and I think is something that we can all remember, is like, because we get asked this a lot, you know, what can I do as an individual? To which the answer is, be less of an individual. I just think that's just it. That just kind of nails it on a very personal level. It's like connecting the personal to the bigger picture. Like, what can I do? Be less centered around you and be more centered around the bigger picture. It's like systems thinking in a maxim. I think that's just brilliant. It's one of the things that John's great. I've been working with him on another project this week, and just seeing him in a room, you know, people just shut up and start listening, and I also just feel welcomed and loved, and it's just something about him that's just he is a twat. He's just so nice and brilliant. I hate him.
Yeah. Can't be doing with this, can we? When are we going to have a guest on who's crap and doesn't know what they're talking about? Because it feels like that falls to me every week.
Well, the thing is, we are going to interview you on another podcast, aren't we, John, where you can be our guest. So if you can fulfil that role if you like.
Excellent. Good. I shall look forward to it.
He's typecasting.
Should be even less informed than usual. Ed, how are you feeling?
I mean, the thing that really sticks with me from what John was saying is the fact that, you know, the story, this consumer story that we draw so many of our supposed solutions from, is the thing that's broken. You know, so if the well from which you're dipping your bucket to try and get the water of refreshment is contaminated, then all of those solutions are kind of compromised. And, you know, we talk a lot about that systemic change piece, but it just feels like you've got to change that story. And, you know, how much effort it takes to sustain that story. You know, I think John used the words bastard hard, but it really is. And I always go back to David Graeber, you know, the sort of great anarchist anthropologist, where he said the world is made of stories and we can change them anytime. And so I'm left sort of upbeat and optimistic, because what John always leaves me thinking is that self-belief piece, that, you know, believing in ourselves is the big hump we have to get over. You know, and that's the inspiration.
That story you told about the Taiwanese government, where he said, you know, oh, you know, people must really trust the government, and the minister turning around going, like, it's not about that, it's whether the government trusts the people.
Yes.
I thought that was very profound.
And we're stuck in the worst of both worlds right now, where, you know, we don't trust the government and the government palpably doesn't trust us.
Yeah.
We are back next week. We have two episodes left in this series, so do keep your suggestions for topics. We are always planning the next one, and we will be lining up guests for series 4 as we speak. And we welcome, of course, your earthly confessions, your emails about what you do when you listen. And the emails that genuinely keep us going are your reactions to specific episodes and people you've spoken to about the topics we've discussed, and changes you've made in your life as a result of listening are absolutely inspiring for us to read. So keep those coming in, and here's how you can reach us. You can reach us by email at hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. That's hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. We have our own show Twitter account, which is @JandTheF. And of course, you can reach us individually on Twitter too. I am @RonRichardson. John Richardson with the first letter swapped around. That's what I've done there. And you can reach Ed and Mark at the following.
I'm Ed Gillespie @Frucool, which is @FRUCOOL.
And I'm Mark Stevenson, and you can find me @OptimistOnTour.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, as ever. Look after each other.
I thought you were going to go back to Radio 4 Voice. I really thought you were going to bookend it. Are you going to do a callback? But you haven't. You've disappointed me.
Well, I was going to go the other way. I was going to make you think I was going to do that, and then I was going to say, fuck you laters, and then leave. Which do you want? You decide which side of the coin you want.
Oh, wow, it's interactive.
Yeah, it's a choose your own adventure.
Turn to page 274 for the clean professional ending.
I would like you to end it in the style of a Russian newsreader.
Okay.
During the Ukrainian invasion.
This is end of broadcast. All has been good. Nobody here culpable for anything bad. We hope you enjoy what is 100% fact. Next episode, we will broadcast live from your living room. We are outside now, ready to come in. Knocking in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Cheerio, tatty, bye.